So I wanted to kind of review the meditation practice as we're going to be practicing today and tomorrow. And I know that some people here have been practicing for years and years and know a lot more about it than I do. And some people may be more new to the practice. But from my perspective, we're kind of all in it together. Thank you. And since this is a program that's focused on studying the teachings in the Profound Treasury, Volume 1, I thought it'd be interesting to say a little bit about history. The teachings in the three volumes are based on what Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, the Vijayadhara, taught in the Vajradhatu seminary programs that went on for 13 years, starting in 1973 and going through 1986. And the very first talk of the very first seminary in 1973 was his presentation on meditation technique. And it was an interesting point, I think, for a number of reasons. One is giving group meditation instruction, I think, was not a common thing at the time. And also, prior to that time, his students had been meditating and had been focusing on the central role of mindfulness and awareness practice. But as far as I know, it was not taught in a group way. And so, for instance, when I first started studying, I went to a program at Karma Chulang, which is called Tale of the Tiger. And in the course of a three-day program, there was an all-day sitting. But there was no instruction. It's just like, okay, tomorrow we have an all-day sitting. Okay. And that was my very first program. And then there was a little tent with cushions made from like things people took off couches, you know, like sections of couch cushions. And some cushions were like stuffed with straw. And it was on this ground that was kind of all wavy and lumpy. And as in group meditation practice, even today, they were alternating sitting and walking meditation. But there were no instructors. And so I remember thinking, well, those other people look like they know what they're doing, and I'll just try to copy them. So all you had to do was when the bell rang, you could figure out people were walking, another bell rang, and you were supposed to sit down again. That was pretty much it. And then that went all day long. And it's really interesting that being in that space where something was going on, but I didn't know exactly what. But for some reason, I decided to do it anyway. And it was an interesting turning point in my life, in that somehow, in my muddledness, I felt that I had re-met like old ancestors. I felt that I had been reconnected with something that I should have been told, and I couldn't understand why everybody didn't know about this or didn't tell me about it. Or it was so kind of a primordial feeling of reconnecting with who I was at a very deep level. Not that I could name it or I had any label for it. And I thought, that's very odd. It didn't make any sense, you know, just sitting and doing nothing, having this feeling of such a kind of raw and heart opening in an unusual way. And in any case, that was how I first got started. And I think, I don't know about you all, but often I think when we first sit down to meditate, it has a kind of a shock in a way. sometimes a shock of discomfort or exposure or confusion or thinking something is supposed to be happening and it isn't, or something is happening that we don't want happening. But in any case, it's an interesting and counterintuitive kind of discipline in our culture where we want to do things and make things happen and see results that we can hold on to and as a credential or some such thing. So anyway, in 1973 seminary, when Rinpoche, the Vijayadhara, started presenting on meditation and saying, well, if we're going to progress along the path and if we're going to really train ourselves to be true Dharmic people, in the group practice, it's good to have a little bit more form. And so some of the old timers, or they thought they were old timers, being arrogant, they'd been studying for 2 years or something, and said, well, we don't want to have to follow a discipline like that. We just want to sit formlessly and, you know, do nothing. And they said, well, that may be okay in private or individual practice, but in group practice, let's go over the basics and let's do shamatha and vipassana properly. And so that's when he introduced forms that pretty much carried through throughout his teaching period, which was 17 years in North America. Another thing about sitting practice is in, for instance, in the first volume of these books, I'd say discussion of sitting and the subtleties and depths and kind of varieties of ways of approaching sitting probably take up at least a third of the book, if not more, maybe half. I don't know. It's a lot of the book straight on sitting, which indicates that it was really important. And it's really what takes a more surface level or merely clever intellectual understanding into more embodied understanding that actually has a transformative effect and can project and help transform our world than the people that we encounter around us. So I'd like to just go over this technique. You may practice many techniques in your life, and that's great. There's a variety. But in the course of the retreat, it would be great if we could try to figure out and work with this technique and see what comes of it, right? So why don't you, you know, stand up and kind of shake up, and we'll begin fresh. And actually stay standing for a little bit. So I think in some ways, what I view is when does a meditation practice start? When you come into the room, it starts as soon as you bow and enter the shrine room. That bowing, the ritual of bowing when you enter into a shrine room or meditation hall is kind of a signal to kind of click in to a more meditative state or more meditative mentality or whatever. So there's a sense of beginning properly. And the Vijayadhara always talked about the importance of beginning properly, doing what you've begun properly, and ending properly. And not mindlessly, just kind of running in and sitting down on your cushion, but coming in, you're already sitting in your mind. In fact, he talked about the attitude being that so you sewed a cushion on your pants or your dress that's carried around with you at all time, which is a great image, having a gomdan stitched on your butt. But anyway.
We're actually going to be doing that.
Good plan. Anyway, So that means when you come in, don't just plop down, you sit down mindfully. So why don't you do that? So I'd like to review sitting practice in terms of the three elements of posture and breath and mind slash heart. And the starting point really is posture. And it's interesting to me that shamatha tends to be translated as mindfulness. Sometimes it's translated as peaceful abiding. But I think the notion of mindfulness, the word mindfulness, implies that it's simply a mental exercise, like going to a gym only with your mind. But I think it's important to realize that it's whole bodied. It's embodied practice. It's not just a mental exercise, and it involves the heart and the physicality, as well as the mentality and those qualities. It involves all the sense perceptions. So the starting point is just to notice, you know, the quality of being embodied. You know, notice how grounded or not grounded you feel. Notice how fidgety or stable you feel. Just notice the boundaries of your body. Just perception. How do you even know you're in a body? You know, what is that all about? And you notice if are you just a floating head with a body hanging underneath it? Or are you a stable support that's kind of connected together? The image of being in a good posture is being like a mountain, you know, with very stable and still and weighty, has weight. And you can tell the difference. Sometimes there's a feeling when you're sitting is almost, the Vijayadhara used to refer to perching, as though you're about to take off, like you're a bird on a twig about to take off, which indicates a sense of discomfort with really settling and being still. So just notice that quality, and as much as possible, imagine that you're solid like a mountain, you're stable, you're still, and there's a sense of uprightness of posture. And always within meditation technique, that's called the middle way of not too tight and not too loose. And with the posture, there's a sense of dignity and a sense of strength, you know, which is from your backbone, your skeletal structure. But there's also a quality of softness and vulnerability in your squishy front parts, at least if you're me, squishy front parts. So there's kind of a physical embodiment of the joining of vulnerability and strength, that they're not in battle, but they are joined. So there's also, the Vijayadhara used to talk a lot about what he called head and shoulders, and the sense of a certain positive pride in having a human form and having a life on this earth for a while. Not in a sense of arrogance, like humans are better than other beings, but in a sense of appreciation of this life that you have, this body you have, however it is, whether it's healthy or sick or strong or weak or beautiful or a wonder, it's fine. So the very first thing when you sit down is to come back into your body and to settle. I was talking with Barry earlier about when you come into a retreat like this from very busy lives and then the busyness of getting here, I think it's sort of like those, if you ever watch the cartoons of the Roadrunner, when he comes racing and he tries to stop and he goes back. It's a little bit like that, this transition period where like the Roadrunners who try to stop for a little bit, hopefully right before we go over the cliff. So settling, weight, uprightness, yet relaxed. That's the physical quality. And then there are different options for posture. One option in terms of the hands is can rest on your thighs gently, and that's called the royal posture, or sometimes it's called the double earth witnessing mudra. And that's a very traditional way of placing the hands. The other option, it's sort of hard with these these things, is the what's called the meditation mudra or the cosmic mudra, in which place you rest one hand on the other and have your thumbs make kind of an oval. And with usually it's said the thumbs should be slightly apart. And then just resting your hands. You don't have to hold them up, but there should be a sense of able to rest your shoulders, relax your shoulders. And sometimes I find it helpful when I'm sitting down, if I feel very tight in one part of the body or other, sometimes I extra tighten them, like the shoulders, and then let them fall. And that sometimes helps. And if you get stiff during practice, you can do that as well. So within that general guideline of posture, of being steady and still as much as possible, again, there's a middle way in terms of, you know, if you really don't want to hurt yourself, you want to be kind to yourself. The ground of the practice is really kindness. And it's also sometimes basic sitting practice is referred to as making friends with yourself, developing kindness, greater kindness to yourself. So in the, as Westerners who aren't used to sitting cross-legged all that much for most of us, one way of being kind is paying attention to if you have a pain in your body, which you may have. And I find that sometimes you have a pain and, you know, immediately you want to do something about it. But if you don't, then the pain goes somewhere else in your body or it disappears. And if you just stick with it for a little while. But if you get into kind of a marine mentality of, you know, dealing with any kind of pain that comes up, no matter what, that can just be a total distraction and you're just dealing with that rather than doing your practice. So at some point, it makes sense to move. Or it may make sense for you in order, especially these long days of practice, to alternate between on a chair and on a cushion or to adjust your posture from time to time. So don't be too rigid, but don't be too indulgent, and every little discomfort doesn't necessarily mean any big drama. It's just a little thought, usually. So the other component of the posture is the gaze, the eyes. And the general guideline is for the eyes to be what's called a diffuse gaze or a relaxed gaze, slightly down, tilted downward. In the old text, it says something about an ox yoke distance or something like that, but most of us don't have ox yokes. So it could be more like distance of, you know, three or four laptops lined up or something like that. And the interesting thing about the gaze is you say, well, why, you know, some people prefer eyes closed and some people prefer eyes open, but from my perspective, the eyes open and relaxed makes a little bit more sense because all of the hearing and the smelling and the physical sensations is not that you're going into a sensory deprivation tank and trying to shut them all off. It's more like letting the senses just flow through. You know, as you're just a hollow and the senses come and go and they don't capture you and you don't battle them. You just let them be. And sometimes it's helpful in terms of the gaze have your eyes could be a little bit half-masked, you know, not all the way open, not closed. That can help. If you find yourself staring, that's going to cause a lot of strain on your eyes and give you a headache. So when you notice if you start staring at one of these bizarre patterns, then you can remind yourself what can might close your eyes and reopen them and try to just relax. So there's a real interesting teaching already there in terms of how we deal with the sense perceptions in a way that's dispassionate as opposed to grasping, the subtle areas, the levels of grasp. So that's posture. So if you can settle into that, that's very good. So, and another thing about posture is sometimes, for some of us, while we're sitting, after a while, we get distracted. And it just does happen. And when that happens, and when distraction becomes really kind of challenging level of distraction, we find ourselves pulled away. One thing that's very, very helpful in terms of regrouping is to come right back to posture, right back to embodiment. And it's a really great thing to practice over and over again, because you can apply it in the midst of life in many situations too, which is so, so helpful. Because when we spin out, when we're anxious, when we freak out, we lose the body and we go into high-speed conceptual thinking. And that doesn't really work very well. It gets kind of not very useful. So some, when we see ourselves doing that in sitting or in life, it's very helpful to be able to just come back, wait a minute, come back, be in the body. Because the grounding and the support of the Mother Earth is so healing and so empowering, it's great. Yeah. So the central aspect of the meditation technique is working with the breathing. And it's great because it's something we all have as long as we're alive, so we don't need a special equipment. And it's very much a very powerful thing to work with, because we really care about our breath. It means we're alive. And if our breath is threatened, we'll do anything to get it back. The breath is really a conveyor of life force in so many ways, and that's why it's so revered in many traditions as something not to take for granted, something to appreciate. Also, the cycle of the breath is so interesting, because in the stillness of the body, being like the mountain, total stillness, there's rhythm and there's movement all the time. And another thing about the breath is that it's a message of complete interdependence with all that is, that we are continually, what's inside of us is going out, and what's outside is coming in. There's a continual exchange happening all the time with our environment. We don't exist without our environment, without air, and we don't exist without one another. We don't exist without all beings, and we don't exist without what's happened in the past, happening now, and might happen in the future. So the breath is simple, intimate, and fraught with meaning. The other thing about the breath is so powerful is that in order to continue, in order to maintain ourselves, we have to continually let go. For any fresh breath to arise, an old breath has to die. So there's a cycle of life and breath, death, that's symbolized by every single breath. There's a birth, a holding, and a letting go. And that attitude of fresh arising, interest in what arises, and letting it go is very powerful teaching. In the technique that the Vijayadhara emphasized, he said, well, settle down, notice your breathing, breathe very naturally. Don't try to breathe some special way. It's not like doing pranayama or that kind of, it's a different practice. And your breath will change. Sometimes it'll be very shallow and quick. Sometimes it'll be slower and deeper. And I'm sure we have opinions about what our breath's supposed to be. And forget about those opinions. It doesn't matter. There's no good way to breathe or bad way to breathe, according to this. And as you breathe, there's an emphasis on the out-breath. There's a breath going out and dissolving into space. As the breath goes out, diffuses and dissolves into space. And that happens, of course, over and over again, hopefully. And interesting thing about the emphasis on the out-breath is the way it's been taught often is that It gives you a little break. You bring your attention to the out breath, it dissolves, and then nothing happens. And then you bring your breath to the out breath, your mind to the out breath, and it dissolves. And you don't worry about the other part. It's kind of gives a little kind of a, almost like a gentle staccato of attention. You just let yourself go. Let yourself go on the breath. So that has many different levels of practice, but the simplest is just noticing the breath going out, and there's a little gap or at the turning point, and then your body naturally breathes in, just does it without having any effort needing to be applied. And so you just touch your breath and let it go, touch your breath and let it go. And one image for that that I found helpful is like flying a kite. You know, you're flying a kite and you have a string and the kite's up in the sky, you hope. And you just keep it up there by a gentle tug of the string. Likewise, you keep your attention on the breath with a gentle tug. So there's no value in really getting total tight and struggling. It's a very gentle touch, a gentle touch. We're having an interest and a gentle touch. So that's what is the, I guess you'd say, the core activity, if you could call it that, of the basic sitting practice. The third component is the mind and emotions, and that's kind of an interesting area of the practice. And that has a couple aspects. One is that it's pretty common to be distracted quite a lot. And the practice there, and when you have thoughts, you have fantasies, you have memories, you have plans, you have grand schemes, all sorts of things arise in your mind as thoughts or images, and all sorts of feelings arise. You know, it may feel, you know, sad, or it may feel lusty, or it may feel, you know, anxious, whatever. Usually when we're trying to deal with mental contents and thoughts, we try to figure them out and we try to, you know, deal with them and utilize them in that way. But in the practice of meditation, we're paying attention to the process of thoughts arising and dissolving and not so much focusing on the content and what we're going to do about it or analyzing what's going on and why, etc. We simply notice the thinking or the activity of the mind and return to the breath. We simply notice and return to the breath. And the interesting thing there is we're instructed or to not be that judgmental about what arises. You know, what arises may be something we think, wow, what, how brilliant I am. Or we may think, oh my God, I'm such a superficial person. The same stupid thought comes up over and over and over again. What's wrong with me? I'll never get anywhere. But that's just another thought. So there's a sense of, can you be kind to your thinking process? Can you just notice it? And you know, not trying to blow it off and not trying to fix it and not trying to fix yourself, but just coming back to the breath, coming back to the breath. Oh, that's interesting. And sometimes that return, that returning is happens, could happen 100 times in a single sitting session. It's just the gentle tap, tap, come back to the breath, come back to the breath. Sometimes if the thinking is more difficult to deal with, you can use the technique of labeling, which is a labeling it thinking, which again, it helps shift one's relationship with thoughts and be less under the control of whatever comes into our mind. It's kind of freeing ourselves from the dominance of impulse and random thinking. And it's a little glimpse of freedom or a level, you might say, as below thoughts or a level of perception that doesn't rely on that kind of conceptuality, but is a more direct kind of perception. So that's pretty much the basic, simple technique. And the I think the best way to practice myself is, I guess, what you call surrendering to the technique and trusting the technique and not thinking too much about it, but just doing it and seeing what happens. And, of course, that takes a certain, you could call it faith, the F word, faith, or you could call it trust, or you could call it inquisitiveness or curiosity or whatnot. That for some reason, this kind of technique has been practiced for thousands of years. And even though whenever I try to actually think about it and try to figure it out, it makes no sense. But when I actually do it, it makes a lot of sense. So that's interesting altogether. So I'm trying to think if I forgot anything. I think that's a good first starting. And again, be kind to yourself, work with your body, and just come back, just come back, just come back, just come back. And we'll talk a lot more about it as we go along. So, any questions? I think you've all done some sitting already, I think. Yeah.